Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can crowdsourcing be used for funding ministry? Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael speaks with Adam Copeland of the Center for Stewardship Leaders at Luther Seminary about trends in congregational stewardship and crowdsourcing.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership and editor of our e-newsletter, Leading Ideas, and I'm here today talking with Adam Copeland, who's a faculty member at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, where he heads up their stewardship leadership efforts. And he's also the editor of a recent book, Beyond the Offering Plate, A Holistic Approach to Stewardship. Adam is also known for his work on crowdfunding and other forms of electronic giving in the church, so I'm excited for the opportunity to talk to somebody else who's a stewardship nerd, like I am. Why don't we begin, Adam, with your book? For those who aren't familiar with the book, it's a compilation of essays that looks at stewardship not in relation just to money or even just in relation to money and time, but looks quite broadly at a whole range of issues through the lens of stewardship, life and death and our bodies and our community and privilege and technology. And it casts about as broad a net as I've ever seen when applying the lens of stewardship to matters of life and faith. So I wondered if we could begin there with how you define stewardship and how you see it as a key construct in the life of faith.
Sure, thanks for the invitation to be here. And yeah, it's always a delight to talk about stewardship. It's a topic I think about almost every day. So it is a joy to share that conversation with other folks. So the book came about because in this work of stewardship leadership at the seminary and in the congregations, I often get asked about folks pushing back against the concept that stewardship is only about money. Folks often in congregations only hear stewardship, the word, as part of the fall campaign to raise funds for the next year's budget. And folks got annoyed when the church is only approaching stewardship that way. So stewardship, I think, is a broader concept that is ultimately about a proper management of resources. So for Christians, this is proper management of all the resources God has entrusted to our care. For me, that certainly includes money, but it's also much broader. So sort of body, mind, spirit, and then these more sort of intangible possibilities that when Christians work together, we can help bring about change. So in terms of a straight-up stewardship definition, one of my favorites is from Carrie Alice Robinson. She has a book called Imagining Abundance. And her definition of stewardship, she says, it's the proper care of all that has been entrusted to one and the recognition of and response to the potential at hand. And I love Carrie's definition because she thinks about the potential at hand. So what can we working together bring about? What's the potential before us? I think for me, stewardship has a lot to do with thinking about the possibilities and listening to the Spirit's potential work within the community.
Huh. That's an interesting twist on it. Of course, I'm used to thinking about stewardship in terms of it being how we care for all the things that God has entrusted to us, but I've never really thought about that little add-on in terms of the potentials at hand. How do you think that, for you, how does that deepen or where does that point you in terms of thinking about stewardship a little bit differently?
Sure. So for me, I think often we think about stewardship just with sort of very basic financial points of view, or you know, things that are already part of our the things we manage. So you know, what's in our bank account, or for our congregation, you know, what property we already own, or things like that. I think stewardship thinking, though, really can reshape the possibilities. And so when there's so many beautiful definitions of stewardship out there. I, with great care, you know, put my toe into the water to develop mine. And I ended up, you know, with Carrie Alice Robinson thinking about the potential, the possibility. So I think practicing stewardship, so I think about stewardship as a lived concept. So what does it look like in practice? I think it's all about the shifts, the reshaping possibilities that happen when we work together. So for me, I think stewardship is a lived concept, and it results in sharing that surprises and compassion that complicates our way of viewing the world normally, and love that inspires. So it's not just this about sort of the simple things that are already part of our lives, but it's about partnering with God in the potential that if we work together and consider the possibilities, something new might be brought about.
Yeah, I love that you used the word partnering with God. That's often language I use to talk, or really, I think, to redefine or reimagine the concept of stewardship. I mean, I think steward is such an unfamiliar concept in the modern world, but I like to use the language of partnership, not only because I think it's a good approximation in some ways for what stewarding is about, but because it does, I think, give us the opportunity to think in bigger terms about what it might be to be partners in God's mission. I love the way you're defining it, because it's so forward-looking and so positive, I think. You're right. I think we tend to think about stewardship in such legalistic and sometimes small ways.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Before we leave this subject of thinking about stewardship more holistically, how can we make sure when we think about stewardship in such broad terms, and when we correctly apply it to so many aspects of our life and so many parts of our Christian walk, how can we make sure that we're not letting people off the hook when it comes to the serious matter of stewardship of their resources?
Absolutely. I really appreciate the question, Anne, because it, in some ways that was one of my anxieties that came about after as part of developing the book Beyond the Offering Plate, because I don't want in any way, you know, that by hosting a conversation about holistic stewardship that ignores or sets aside the question about financial stewardship. I think overall, you know, financial stewardship is there's a reason it brings up anxieties and concerns and challenges in the church, is because we as a U.S. church have never really figured out how to approach financial stewardship well.
Right.
So I completely affirm where the question is coming from. For me, I think there's two things that congregations and congregational leaders can approach financial stewardship in a way that maybe can straddle, you know, both fences here. So one would be to talk about money when we're not asking for it.
Yeah, right.
So I think there's this sense, in some ways, you know, perfectly rightly, that when it comes to, you know, the fall stewardship campaign, the church leaders are only talking about money all the time. And that may be true for, you know, 2 to 4 weeks or however long the campaign may last. But if money never comes up again in the life of the church, then we're not really talking about stewardship. We're just doing a basic fundraising campaign, and not a very good one, because one that sort of tires people out,
right,
and doesn't help them associate the dreams and potential and vision of the congregation, but just, you know, tries to, you know, take their money. So ideally, you know, when congregations can approach money year round, and not just when we're asking for it, but in the real places where people are wrestling with money. And that relates to the second possibility. I think in addition to just talking about money when we're asking for it, church tends to only talk about money when in regards to that portion we might give to the church. So whatever it is, you know, 1 to 10% you know, traditionally, that we might, you know, give to charity or give to the church. I think, though, the Christian faith and more holistic stewardship thinking might push us in the direction of saying, wait a second, if Jesus is Lord of my life, and if the church is helping me live a life of discipleship, it's that 90% that I have a lot of questions about, and that is my holistic vocation. How can the congregation help me think through how to live and spend and invest with all my money, that not just the, you know, 1 or 2 or 10% I give to the church, but it all. And so that's holistic stewardship, but it's also financial stewardship. And it's for me, I think it allows huge possibilities and entry points for the actual concerns about people's lives. And I think that's a little bit of the time and talent card possibilities as well, that are trying to get at, you know, what do people really care about? And how can the church help them manage those resources and those gifts? And if we're just doing a, you know, old school traditional fundraising campaign, we're not getting at any of those deeper questions about the gospel and deeper questions about vocation.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful, because I think the idea that if you talk about one aspect of stewardship, you're going to deflect from a different aspect of stewardship, you know, assumes that you're only going to talk about stewardship 3 or 4 weeks out of the year. And the way to talk about all of the different aspects of stewardship without one sort of taking away from the other is to really understand that this is a conversation that needs to be going on all throughout the year. Well, if we could shift gears a bit from the sort of the theological to the practical, I wanted to focus a bit on the work that you've done related to electronic giving and crowdfunding in particular. I see you anyways as an advocate for new forms of giving, new technologies of giving in the church, and various types of electronic giving. Can you speak broadly to the trends that you're seeing?
Sure. So, and I'll start by saying I really had a change of heart about all this. For a while, I always thought about, you know, electronic giving as an opportunity for the church to sort of trick people into more regular giving. So, and this likely is a conversation that's familiar to members of a stewardship committee, that so electronic giving in several different forms allows the possibility for folks to set up automatic giving from a bank account or debit card or credit card. And so, you know, those folks on the stewardship committee think, well, golly, if we can only get folks to sign up for, you know, a weekly or monthly gift, then when they're away in the summer, we've tricked them into giving throughout the year already. And there's, you know, there's not, there's some truth to that. But for me, what really sort of shifted my approach to it, electronic giving, is approaching it instead with a frame of hospitality. So it turns out, and we know this because Vanco Payment Solutions conducted a pretty detailed study a few years ago about electronic giving. It turns out that actually church members have, on the whole, a preference for electronic giving. So if we frame the conversation around electronic giving with the frame of hospitality, how can we allow our members to give in the ways they feel called to give and in the ways they give to every other opportunity, then ideally we can get past some of those initial hesitations among folks for that might get just scared about changes in the church and the just the fact that, you know, technology might be involved in worship or in stewardship in a different way.
Yeah, I'm beginning to see some of these issues about digital giving as, well, and I think other kinds of stewardship challenges as well, are really a microcosm of some bigger issues in the church about how the church connects with people in a digital age. It's not just how people give, it's how people are in relationship and how people spend their time and how people connect. in an age where a lot happens through digital medium. I mean, I think there are big questions for churches in general in terms of, you know, attendance and how people worship, and we're increasingly likely moving to a world where more of that is going to be less place dependent, less time specific. It's going to be moving into a realm of more digital and online, and so it's not just giving. It's mm-hmm. the whole way that people are connecting to the community of faith is likely to be shifting in this direction, and giving is just one piece of it. Do you agree with
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Yeah. And for me, you know, I'm not trained as a historian, but I think about stewardship a lot, and I know some of the history in terms of the stewardship world, and it's helpful for me to remember that. Two pieces that the U.S. church has never really figured out how to fund ourselves well. And so we've been asking this question about how do we fund our ministries since the founding of the United States. And these may feel like particularly challenging questions today, but actually the church has been wrestling with them for ages. And technology actually plays a role in this. So you can actually find the time when the fancy newfangled technology of a paper offering envelope was invented. And folks in the early 1900s and then after the single opening envelope was invented, this magical duplex envelope system that had two areas where you could put money in, one for mission giving and one for general giving, was invented. And there were pastors writing in the 1910s, 1920s that thought that this new technology was absolutely going to revolutionize giving. And they're writing new budgets because giving was going to go up 3 or 4%. Yeah. It didn't. It didn't. So this, you know, this wrestling with technology certainly feels like particularly a pressing challenge today, but especially when it comes to financial stewardship, it's not completely new in that the church has been longing for some sort of magical tool that will shift how people give to the church and what percentage of their income they give to the church. And it turns out that a tool in and of itself isn't going to magically change our hearts. It's instead sort of this deeper question about our relationship with God and our relationship with money. And then how can the church help us wrestle with those questions and meet us where we are? Again, if you look at the history of giving, the average giving rate for as long as we have records is around 2% of after-tax income to the church. So I think and today it's maybe, you know, we've gotten to 2.4% or something in some mainline denominations, but it's still much closer to zero than 10%. So if we start the conversation in congregations around stewardship with that 10% tithing number, I think we can really just provoke anger or shame or just feel like we're completely irrelevant to those the conversations that folks are having around giving and household budgets.
Right. I want to move to the question of crowdfunding, because you've written about that. And can you define that for people who may not be familiar with that term or how it's being used by churches?
Sure. Yeah. And so basically crowdfunding and in congregations, this may sound in some ways like our traditional stewardship campaigns, but it's basically asking the crowd, sort of many people, to give lots of small donations to help fund a larger project. So they're often goal-based. So websites like Indiegogo or GoFundMe mm-hmm. or Generosity.com is actually just got bought out, so it's going to be YouCaring. Folks asking for a particular financial goal and inviting then the crowd or this sort of the internet community to, if they support the goal, to give small amounts towards it so that together they might bring about some change.
This just sounds like fundraising to me, or maybe fundraising in the electronic era or in the realm of social media. So, is that how you see it?
Yeah. So, I think in sort of a pure sort of crowdfunding is a little different from a traditional fundraising campaign. So, and here's why I'll sort of make a exaggerated example to make the point. A traditional crowdfunding campaign, so Kickstarter, say, which developed around 2009, an artist would approach the community and say, I have this idea, I have this thing that I would like to see exist in the world. I think it's an amazing possibility. It's, you know, recording an album or writing a play or making this product. But I think this is an amazing possibility, but it's only going to come about if we hit this goal together. And so, crowd, I would like you to tell me if this is a good idea after all. So if so, partner with me, give, ask your friends to give, and together we can make this thing happen. But if you don't do that, and I don't hit the goal, all your money will be refunded. And I will have learned that my individual idea, something that I thought was amazing, was actually not appreciated by the crowd, and that will actually be some valuable information for me. So those are called sort of all or nothing campaigns or fixed crowdfunding campaigns. Mm-hmm. For me, that initial blooming of crowdfunding in 2008, 2009 started with more of that sort of artist supported crowdfunding ventures, and now it's become, you know, 9-10 years later, this more sort of electronic fundraising, digital giving free for all. And there's all these new possibilities that have cropped up as folks, live into the potential of some sort of electronic fundraising.
Yeah, so I guess that's helpful to think about it that way. I guess I can see how that kind of crowdfunding or fundraising works when you're imagining a new initiative or an exciting new initiative that people might really feel motivated to give to, a new building, some kind of new ministry initiative. But I guess it raises the same question that other kinds of designated giving raise in my mind. It's attractive often for people to give to kind of the sexy things, the new ideas, the really compelling mission projects. And then what's left is what churches spend the majority of their money on, which is keeping up their building and paying their staff. Does crowdfunding work as a way of helping churches finance their ongoing institutional expenses?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I would say sort of a strong no. So in my research with crowdfunding, and I've actually, I'm writing a dissertation on this. I've worked with about 10 congregations or faith-related nonprofits, and only 3 of them ended up launching a campaign because of just the huge challenge that for the congregations or nonprofits of coming up with an idea that is an appealing crowdfunding campaign as well as supporting the mission of the organization. And you're right, that general annual giving or, you know, sort of upkeep, all those, you know, important mission-driven, you know, pieces that we ask our members or regular supporters to help fund, those don't end up making a very good crowdfunding campaign. They tend to be sort of, the best ones are one-off things that with a very specific goal that's time sensitive and has the sense that this can only be created or only be accomplished with the help of the community.
Yeah.
So churches, that's a very different way of thinking for most congregations. And relatedly, Well, and I'll just leave it here. And we also haven't developed a funding network or potential givers, or to think about it rhetorically, or another audience to support our congregations. Usually when we think about giving, it's the audience we're appealing to is basically those folks who are with us on Sunday mornings, or our members. Crowdfunding, when it comes to audience, really shifts those possibilities. And congregations struggle with honing a message or even and thinking about the types of questions that folks beyond their congregations might be asking.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really important aspect to this, because it does open up the possibility of people beyond the congregation getting excited about and supporting some of the work that the congregation does. And I think that's the great promise of this. I think that's true with lots of types of designated giving. It's not just, you know, crowdfunding mechanisms. But yeah, I mean, I think that's really a really critical piece of this. I know when I first got started in stewardship ministry about 25 years ago, any kind of designated giving or fundraising was really kind of poo-pooed. And I was taught you never should nickel and dime people, because you need to be putting all your emphasis on you know, making sure that they're given everything they can solidly through their ongoing pledge. And then once they've done that, we should never ask them to give any, you know, anything more. And I don't think that's the way it works anymore. I think we have to have a both-and approach. I think that people learn to give often through these more interesting kinds of appeals, where they really understand the connection between what they're being asked to give and what it's supporting, and that they can get excited about it. And hopefully that becomes the way in which they start to see the potential of giving and then become more regular through whatever means.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Sort of folks have shifted from this time of thinking about giving out of more obligation or duty to, you know, a time of giving that's more about personal choice and a result of cultivation. And so that initial gift to, you know, a particular designated, you know, mission opportunity is a, you know, step along the path of maybe moving towards a more, you know, regular or annual gift.
Let me ask a couple final questions to wrap this up. So this is kind of a hard one. It's maybe a little bit of a curveball, but I wanted your thoughts. If you could kind of put on your futurist hat and think like 20 or 30 years into the future, where do you think things are going to be in terms of how people respond to the call to generosity?
Yeah, that's. I'm teaching a course at the moment on church planning. So I'm working with students a lot in these questions in terms of, you know, how do we get at starting a new faith community? And golly, very few students have the notion of, you know, expecting folks to give, you know, 10% of their income to the church to help, you know, keep the building up and keep the pastor employed and with, you know, health insurance and a pension. So there is, you know, huge shifts at hand. In terms of, you know, what does it look like 20 years from now, just practically speaking, there is going to be a huge shift in wealth. And for congregations that are thoughtful about legacy gifts, estate planning, and endowments that have planned well, we're going to have some congregations that have huge amounts of money in the bank and very few people in the pews.
There are already congregations like
right,
that.
Yeah. And so I think that has huge potential for creativity if we sort of live into those possibilities. I think on the whole, the congregations that are going to be successful are going to get at more of this question around sort of holistic thinking and sort of money relationship in general. So those that are saying, how do we live well in this consumer culture? And how do we give not just to the church, but to charities, that sort of thing. So among my students, you know, who are often in their 20s, there's this great support and yearning for an affinity with the minimalist movement and the tiny house folks and those sorts of usually secular groups that are really pushing against consumer culture and the emphasis on buying and owning and acquiring. Our students are saying, no, the call of Jesus tells me to live life in a different way. But they go to church and they don't hear any of that. And so I think the churches that are thinking honestly about our relationship with things, our relationship with money, are going to help live us more vitally into the future.
Let me ask you two final questions. We always ask the people that we're interviewing for our podcasts two questions, and so let me pose them to you. One is, what are you reading right now?
That's a good question. Let's see. Most recently, and we're juxtaposing these books in class. I finished the bestseller by J.D. Vance, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis, and I'm putting that up against and in a conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates' letter to his son a few years ago, Between the World and Me. So both sort of secular readings, but really wrestling with what is going on at this cultural moment with race and poverty and political divisions. And I'm trying to get students to embrace the secular conversations as we think about, what does faith have to do with it?
Fascinating. Yeah, that's really fascinating. Okay, last question. So if you had to name a leader who's really been inspirational to you, who would it be?
Ooh, that's a good one. So I think in terms of, all ministry, but particularly stewardship, although it's not somebody who's in the stewardship leadership circle, I think of a seminary professor who at the time taught at Columbia Seminary in Decatur, Georgia, named Charles Campbell, a professor of homiletics. Now he's at Duke Divinity. Chuck, really, I took several classes from him in seminary and really formed me as somebody who's never comfortable with the given Christian institution or in the given Christian way of living. So I remember at a coffee hour one day, Chuck had just given a sermon. It related to money and power in one way or the other. And at Columbia, there has these old houses that probably would go if they ever went on the market, for $500,000, $1 million in this beautiful Decatur, Georgia neighborhood. And I asked Chuck, are you ever uncomfortable with, living in this gorgeous house and having this pretty cushy life as a tenured faculty member when all the time you're preaching against, about the possibilities of Christianity and the call to mission? And he looked me in the eye and he said, Adam, every single day. And that has stuck with me because it's, I think, good leadership these days in the church is never comfortable with the status quo and never just leaning into that institutional version of Christianity. And so I hope that every single day we're not comfortable with our buildings just sitting there or the assets we have or the even if we're running a healthy budget, the numbers on the bottom of the income spreadsheet. But it's asking questions about how does Jesus push us to those places of discomfort and reframing how we're living our daily lives. So Chuck Campbell.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's actually a great concluding word for our conversation, I think, as well. So I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us. I'm so admiring of the work that you're doing, and I know that our listeners and our readers are really going to appreciate it. So thank you so very much for this and for all you're doing, Adam.
Well, you're welcome, Anne. Thanks for the opportunity and blessing in all your leadership tasks as well.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the Lewis Center Budget Bundle. The bundle includes two video toolkits, building and funding your capital budget, and developing your operating budget. The Lewis Center Budget Bundle is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. On the next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Ann Michael speaks with Reverend William Labar, pastor of the historic Metropolitan AME Church in downtown Washington, D.C., about how older churches can thrive in changing urban contexts.
I think for us, there is a recalcitrance and a stubbornness to us that we will not leave because our mission is not fulfilled in the city and our God has not left. And our witness may well be more necessary than it was when we were founded.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.